have, for the first 25, is it going to be 25 or 20? 25 minutes, William Smoller, representing Sherry Storm. 20 minutes, Virginia Newcomb, representing Legion Insurance Company. 10 minutes, Michael Hogan, representing Dr. Castillo. And then 5 minutes in rebuttal, William Smoller. Counsel, Mr. Smoller, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Members of the Supreme Court, I am Attorney William Smoller. I represent the plaintiff in this case, appellant Sherry Storm, who is present here with me today. I also represent her children, who at the time of this lawsuit were minors but are now adults. As this court knows, and as may be benefit to others here, Ms. Storm attended a trial in Appleton, Wisconsin in February of 1997, wherein her former psychiatrist, Dr. Olson, was accused of malpractice. Ms. Storm attended that trial, having not seen Dr. Olson since August of 1992, when he stopped giving her therapy and when he left Appleton. She had, in the interim, seen Valerie Hamilton, who was a master's level therapist, who had conducted therapy for the month after Dr. Olson left, and who conducted that therapy out of the same office of Dr. Olson and was billed through the same entities as Dr. Olson, and who continued the same type of therapy as Dr. Olson through September of 1992. Ms. Storm also had seen other therapists, including, after that, including another defendant in this case, Dr. Cooper, who was recommended to Sherry Storm by Dr. Olson. Actually, the recommendation was to Dr. Cooper's partner, a doctor named Dr. Peters. Sherry saw Dr. Peters and then was transferred to Dr. Cooper. And that therapy continued through 1993. Ms. Storm also saw a variety of other providers, both between that time, the time of Dr. Olson and Dr. Cooper, and after that time. While Ms. Storm sat in the trial in Appleton, she came to realize that the case in Appleton was virtually identical to what had happened to her. That is, that she was a functional person with minor problems. She was employed, a family member. She was doing reasonably well and had simply gone to see a psychiatrist for minor adjustment problems. In fact, that psychiatrist, Dr. Olson, began to hypnotized her repeatedly, and alleged memories were retrieved. Sherry Storm came to believe, as did the other patient of Dr. Olson, that her past was entirely different than what she had earlier believed it to be. Rather than having a normal childhood, she believed that she was a victim of repeated abuse. Rather than having parents who loved her, she came to believe that her parents sexually abused her. Rather than being raised among a family and friends, she came to believe that she was a member of a satanic cult. Like the other patient, Ms. Storm is a victim of something called false memories. This court has dealt with a couple other cases related to the concept of false memories in both the Sawyer and Johnson cases. Only by hearing what was going on in the other trial did Ms. Storm come to realize the possibility, by listening to the experts in that trial, that she came to learn how memory works, how suggestion works, how hypnosis works, and the possibility that this newfound reality and history of hers was in fact in error. By then, Sherry had already been declared mentally ill. The earlier word for that was insane. She had been declared totally disabled. This came as a result of a report written by Dr. Olson, supported by others, that Sherry was totally non-functional, unable to work, and totally disabled. She was haunted by heinous images conjured up during hypnosis. She was consuming dramatic psychotropic drugs prescribed to her by her physician. She was suicidal and had been hospitalized on a variety of psychiatric units, both within and outside of Wisconsin. Sherry Storm's medical records are something akin to 3 or 4 feet wide related to her psychiatric admissions. Her reality was confused. She simply did not know what was real and what was not real. In April of 1997, she contacted a lawyer, me, and she asked for assistance on whether or not she, like the other patient, had a medical malpractice claim against Dr. Olson. The court should note that it has received a revised version of a document that it had been given to it. There was a typographical error in that document. Mr. Hogan has kindly corrected that. It shows that counsel was retained in April of 96. In fact, counsel was retained in April of 97. So in 97 was the first time that Ms. Storm made contact for the purpose of seeing if she too had a claim against Dr. Olson. 5 months later, a lawsuit was commenced against Dr. Olson and Dr. Cooper, that being in September of 97. Unfortunately, immediately after that, as referred to in the briefs, defendants in that case asked the trial court to enter an order over the vigorous objection of plaintiffs, that order being to not allow plaintiffs to conduct discovery until the deposition of Ms. Storm was completed. That deposition was not completed for close to 2 years, and plaintiff was foreclosed from discovery during that period of time, until finally bringing back to the trial court's attention the fact that plaintiff was stymied in efforts to get information. When the court allowed for the plaintiff to conduct discovery in 1999, plaintiff then obtained additional information and found out that Dr. Cooper was in fact supervised by a Dr. Castillo. And after obtaining the documents that showed that Dr. Castillo had assumed responsibility for the management of the care rendered by Dr. Cooper, plaintiff amended the complaint and filed suit against Dr. Castillo as well. There are different motions before this court and that were before the trial court which relate to the issues of whether or not statute of limitations impact on this claim. It should be very clear, let me just briefly outline, plaintiffs believe that as it relates to Dr. Olson, there are two reasons why the statute of limitations does not interfere with this claim. One is the combination of 893.55 sub 1 sub A along with 893.16. In other words, the 3-year personal injury statute of limitations contained in sub A and the 5-year disability statute contained in 893.16. That's one. The second one is 893.55.1B. And the continuum of negligent treatment. That arises from the fact that Valerie Hamilton, and only Valerie Hamilton, is important to this issue, extended her care through September of 92. This case was filed in September of 97, therefore within 5 years, and therefore fits within the sub B 5-year statute of repose. So that's the second one as it relates to Olson. The only one as it relates to Dr. Castillo is the first issue related to Dr. Olson. That is the combination of 893.55 sub 1 sub A and 893.16. Let me return to those if I may. The first question I believe the court must decide is, does the statute of repose in 893.55 sub 1 sub B prohibit an action after 5 years under sub A? And I think the briefs were very clear, and I think the statutes are very clear on that. The 5-year statute of repose in 893.55 sub 1 sub B applies only to the notice provision in sub B. How do we know that? We know that because of the language of that statute, which reads, an action may not be commenced under this paragraph more than 5 years. We need only look to the statute book to see what a paragraph is, and a paragraph is defined as that which is set forth in the statutes in parentheses in lowercase letters. That's precisely what we have here. Therefore, nothing, no action under the notice provision of sub B may be commenced under after 5 years. As I said, in the first instance, we are under sub A. Therefore, it doesn't apply. The court has already recognized this in the Paul case on page 538, paragraph 48, where it refers to the fact that sub A and sub B are distinct. And so,
One question, counsel, yes. With respect to Dr. Castillo, when would his, if you're correct that the combination of .551A and 893.16 keep him in the ball game, so to speak.
Yes.
When does he get out of the ballpark? When does that time end?
Well, you would take 3 years from when Dr. Cooper ended her therapy, which was September of 93.
Okay.
So that would be 96 plus 5 years for disability, which would make it 01. So September of 01. And in that regard, if I may respond to the question of the argument by Dr. Castillo that the hiring of a lawyer somehow changes the disability, let me say at this point, I dispute that. That's a notice question. In other words, hiring a lawyer may give you notice, but hiring a lawyer does not remove a disability, just like hiring a lawyer doesn't remove minority or doesn't remove imprisonment. The disability continued for 5 years. Therefore, Ms. Storm is entitled to a 5-year disability extension and a 3-year statute of limitations.
Mr. Smoller, how do you establish the disability?
Well,
do you go on the diagnosis that you're now taking issue with, or what do you use to do that?
That's a wonderful question, and I've struggled with that because the fact of the matter is that cuts both ways. You understand, the defense can't say she isn't disabled and therefore isn't entitled to it because, of course, they have, number one, said she is disabled, and because they believe they aren't guilty of malpractice because they believe it's a proper diagnosis. I, on the other hand, would say, yes, she is disabled, but I would not say she's disabled because she earlier suffered from multiple personality disorder. She now suffers from it. That is, her personality was fractured by virtue of therapy that caused her to believe that there was a Mary inside and then a Nancy inside and a variety of other people inside. So, yes, she's disabled. How do I establish that? I think it's a fact determination, and I think at this point, summary judgment, we have established that both by Dr. Olson's letter and by the evaluation by Dr. Spiro, which is made a part of this record, wherein he says she's clearly totally disabled. We also could look to the Social Security Administration determination that she was totally disabled.
So you don't think this is the kind of case where there should be a remand for a factual determination?
No, I don't. I think that the trial court might ultimately ask that question as a special verdict question, but I to have a trial within a trial, I would resist, and I suspect others would. We might be talking about a very lengthy trial to decide a threshold question that could easily be decided on a special verdict.
Counsel, I'm sorry, could you? Sorry.
Well, I was going to ask somewhat the same question as Justice Crooks. Mental illness. When would you say that began?
That's going to be a hard question to answer, and that, too, is a very good question. I would assume that it began before Dr. Olson wrote that letter. Where in that process it began, it may have begun before Sherry Storm ever went to see him. That might be a question of fact. It may be that she had something before then. I don't know. But it certainly occurred before the end of Dr. Olson's treatment, because long before that, she had been told to be off work, she had become non-functional, she had been psychiatrically admitted. But it'd be hard for me to peg a date.
I don't want to ask an inappropriate question, but would you say she's mentally ill now?
Absolutely.
She's mentally...
And, And with all due respect to my client, she would not dispute that and has no trouble with this. This is somebody who is haunted by these images, and these are horrific images. I mean, these false memories are images of terrible, terrible events that, like post-traumatic stress disorder, I believe that the psychiatrist in this case will diagnose her, and some have already, as having post-traumatic stress disorder. Not because she was sexually abused as a child, but because she has experienced multiple years of therapy conjuring up these images where she believed and relived experiences as if they were true.
What is mental illness?
Well, that's a tough question. I don't know. That's perhaps the question that this court may have to decide and maybe doesn't need to decide in the context of this case. Is mental illness simply a label? Is it because you fit within the DSM? I don't think so. As somebody who works in this area a whole lot, I think probably not. We could find some pretty slight diagnoses in the DSM that would not suggest that it's mental illness. Does it go to a functional level? Maybe.
Also, I just wanted to ask. Sure. Sorry. Go ahead. Finish your...
Okay. Maybe. But I think in this case, regardless of where it goes, Sherry Storm fits it. I mean, this is a woman who is psychiatrically admitted, who is suicidal, who is non-functional.
Let me just ask one other question before we go to Justice Wilcox. Is the mental illness in the statute something different from, say, insanity in a criminal context?
I think it is. I think it is.
And why do you know that?
I don't know that. I think that, and I think that because there's a variety of statutes that deal with mental illness in a variety of different contexts, and I'm going to have trouble saying which one is which, but I don't think it rises to the I can't help my counsel. I'm totally unable to do that. I think it certainly may include being infirm and not recognizing what's going on, and somebody who has alternative realities fits kind of in that, in my opinion.
What was troubling me, and this is in response to some of your answers to Justice Prosser's questions, was to fit under 893.16, which is mental illness, you would have to, in other words, that allows for the extension, and then you said that this court will have to decide whether she was mentally ill. And maybe I misheard what you said, but is this record sufficient in that area?
I think not. And so if that's, I said that, I misspoke. I think that's a fact question, and this court shouldn't really have to grapple.
That's why I'm... Okay.
But you do, I believe, you do have to make some kind of assessment of does this case potentially fit within 893.16? I mean, you know, anybody can claim they're mentally ill, but this isn't a frivolous claim in this case. So I think we've made that threshold showing.
So the jury is going to have to decide mental illness.
Perhaps.
What instruction are you going to give it to define mental illness?
Well, I don't know, but if I had to guess, I mean, I obviously would want to think that through more carefully, but I suspect it would be somebody who is not able to understand their rights and understand their function. It's the term disability, and I apologize. I probably would look to the ADA or other terms for disability, but it would go to both understanding and functioning.
A mental illness is that which would render your client with insufficient mental ability to know she had a potential malpractice claim against the doctors and to file them timely. That satisfy you?
I might take issue with the word potential, but I get close to that. Yes.
Alleged.
I'd have to look at that, but yes, it gets pretty close.
All right. Do you think our court has to say something about that if we're going to say your client has a mental illness, so we have to say what we think a mental illness is?
Would you mind reading me that again?
Not at all. I think I got it from one of the briefs. If not, I don't think I was smart enough to make it up. Mental illness actually rendered your client with insufficient mental ability to know she had a potential, if you prefer, alleged malpractice claim against the doctors and to file the claim timely.
I think I probably, if I'm advocating this, because we may be making law here, and if I were, it might go back to the criminal thing, which is also and or assist in the prosecution of that claim.
Okay.
If we added that, I'd feel a whole lot better.
All right, I'll add that. Counsel, does 893.16 enlarge 893.55(1)(b)?
Well, I certainly think that it could. I don't see anything that says that it doesn't, but I don't think we have to reach that in this case.
Well, you've got to get 5 years, one way or another. One way you get 5 years is to say 893.16 enlarges 55(1)(a).
Yes.
Another way you get to 5 years is you say 893.55(1)(b) does not give you 5-year repose. You have to say that, right?
Right, but I'm not taking that position. I am instead taking the position of the continuum of negligence, and to me that's basically a gimme. Which is, I mean, Valerie Hamilton is with Dr. Olson, and this is plain and simply an extension of his care, and so quite frankly, the action was filed within that period of time, recognizing that it fit within Valerie Hamilton. When you get a set of records like this, and what they are is a set of bills, ultimately, that say service rendered on these dates, it doesn't necessarily tell you it's Valerie Hamilton versus Dr. Olson until after you conduct depositions 2 years later to find out what the different entries mean in terms of who saw who when.
How do you get, you need the theory of continuous treatment in order to get to Dr. Castillo. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct.
Okay, give me the dates then. If you don't have that theory applied, the dates for Dr. Castillo, as I understand it, is that on March 1993, the plaintiff discharged from Castillo's care, and 5 years from that would end...
Could I fix that,
sure.
Justice Bradley?
It's, mm-hmm.
Actually, Castillo's, the March is a hospitalization under Dr. Castillo.
Okay.
That's not where issue is taken with his care. His care is while Dr. Cooper is rendering therapy, and that extends all the way to September of 93. So if you start with September of 93, Dr. Cooper, under Dr. Castillo's supervision, is going down the false memory path, okay? So you start there, you go 5 years for an extension for disability, which takes you a toll until September of 98, and you add the 3-year sub A statute of limitations. Does that
mm-hmm.
help?
Again, when did the cause of action accrue? With regard to Castillo?
Well, that's a definitional problem.
Okay.
Give me a generic response
to that question.
The last day of service was September 24th of 93. On top of that, then, are the two different statutes that impact.
Okay. So if you get 3 years on that, you're into 96. That's
correct.
Your next one. And then if you say 5 years because of a disability, mental illness, it gets you 8 years, so you're up to beyond where the 97, where there's a filing.
Well, but see, yes, filing, but Castillo isn't included until aught.
Right.
So I need to get to 01. So if you add 8 to 93, you get to 01 for Dr. Castillo.
Counsel.
Yes.
I'd like you to address for a moment the seeming inconsistency or actually seeming contradiction between 893.55.1a and 893.16. Specifically, 893.55.1 provides, in relevant part anyway, that the action shall be commenced within the later of 3 years or 1 year from the date. So that seems to be very, very clear. And if we didn't have 893.16, you'd be out of the courtroom, right? You wouldn't have an argument. But then we've got 893.16, which completely contradicts, seemingly contradicts 893.55(1). 16 provides for the additional 5 years. Now, that's two contradictory statutes. What do we do with them?
And with all due respect, I very much appreciate that question. It's what I most need to talk about. And I don't see a contradiction at all. I think these things fit together perfectly. And the demonstration of that is in B, it says, under this paragraph. So the statute of repose only relates to the 1 year from notice. Now the question is, what was the legislature's intent about how 893.16 fits with that? You can look at a variety of places and you can find that. The first one being in 893.16. If you look at sub 5, sub B, it says very clearly what statutes are exempted from the application of 893.16. 893.55 is not one of those. Two, if you look to...
That's subsection 5, right?
That's subsection 5B, correct. Mm-hmm. And if the legislature wanted to exempt 893.55 from it, they would have put that in 893.16. So they didn't. Second, if you look at 893.56, it says it doesn't apply if somebody is disabled or imprisoned. Why wouldn't 893.56 apply if somebody was disabled or imprisoned? Because otherwise it would conflict with 893.16. So when they remove that, it says now it doesn't conflict with 893.16. The only place where it did conflict was with minors. And so 893.56 says, as to minors, we're going to change that. But that implies we didn't change it as to people who were imprisoned at that time, now it's been removed, or people who were disabled. And so I think they fit together perfectly.
Well, the bottom line is you want to go to trial.
You bet.
Okay.
5B has been the law all of the relevant times?
I believe so. Ever since there was a dramatic change in the numbering and other things to fit this all together, and 5B was included at that time of the renumbering. You bet. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smoller. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Newcomb, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you.
You represent Legion Insurance Company.
I represent Dr. Olson and Legion Insurance Company.
Thank you.
I am here for Attorney Patricia White, who did the brief. She is quite ill, so this has been an invigorating experience for me since Saturday about noon. I've tried to take what I hope is a fresh look at some of these issues, and I hope I can be of some assistance to the court. First of all, let me say that in looking at this case, this is on a summary judgment motion, and I don't believe that there is any dispute but that Dr. Olson and Legion Insurance Company have put forth a prima facie case for summary judgment. And what Mr. Smoller's burden is here is to try to convince you that the facts really aren't the facts and the law really isn't the law, because he wants to change the law to have a trial. And so what I think we have to look at when you look at everything is what the pleadings suggest and what was submitted in opposition to the motion for summary judgment. I note quite vividly in the Paul case to which Mr. Smoller referred that one of the deciding factors in Justice Crook's opinion was the fact that in opposition to a motion for summary judgment on a statute of limitations issue, the plaintiff had put into evidence an affidavit which established when the injury occurred. The affidavit was from the plaintiff's expert, and the court found that most persuasive. If you look at the pleadings in this case, there is no allegation that Sherry Storm has any disability. In fact, the opening paragraph simply state that Sherry Storm is an adult resident of the state of Wisconsin. There is nothing that establishes that Sherry Storm has a mental illness for which she is disabled at all relevant times in this action.
Is that a pleading requirement, counsel?
I believe it is, because if you have a minor, you must plead that. And a minor is a disability under 893.16. Also, in terms of 893.16, on page 31 of the plaintiff's brief, it states, Sherry has always maintained that she has been disabled from shortly after Olson began treatment through the present day. One of the requirements of 893.16 is that the disability must exist at the time of the negligence. And that is not the case here, as is conceded in the plaintiff's brief. Another important point is to keep in mind in this is that Dr. Olson is a psychiatrist who is covered by Chapter 655 and 893.55. He has a constitutional right to rely on the same statute of limitations as any other health care provider in the state of Wisconsin.
Counsel, I'm sorry. My mind is about four sentences behind you.
That's okay.
And that is, disability must exist at the time of the the mental illness must exist, or the disability must exist at the time of the negligence. And you said that law is clear in this state. Why is it, is the law clear that it must exist at the time of the negligence as opposed to the time of the injury?
To correct myself, I think if we turn to 893.16.4, I'm sorry.
It says, if a person entitled to bring an action at the time of the cause of action accrues,
sometimes the cause of action can accrue, normally it accrues at the time of negligence, but sometimes the cause of action accrues at the time of the, if you will, discovery of the injury.
That's true. But in this case, I think the plaintiff has conceded throughout the briefing process that the cause of action accrued not later than the date of Olson's last treatment, if you forget the continuous course of negligent treatment doctrine. So that would be August 3 of 1992. So the disability would have had to have existed as of August 3, 1992, if you don't buy into the continuous course of negligent treatment doctrine. And based on the admission in the brief, and based on the argument, it's clear that the disability that is being claimed here did not exist at that time, but rather after. And in fact, there was a Social Security filing after that. I'd also like to point out to the court, in terms of the continuous course of negligent treatment doctrine, that Valerie Hamilton is not a health care provider under Chapter 655. She is a social worker. Negligent or not, it isn't alleged in the complaint that she's negligent. She's a social worker who does not fit the definitions within Chapter 655, and therefore I don't believe that we can even consider her in the course of the continuous course of negligent treatment doctrine. Finally, if you look at in the complaint again, in the amended complaint, even in the amended complaint, when I looked carefully to try to determine what it was that was being claimed, Dr. Olson improperly prescribing medications, misdiagnosing Ms. Thorne for multiple personality disorder, improperly introducing religious themes, implanting false memories. These things, I believe, fall squarely within the 89355 purview. Now, Chapter 655, this court has said in the past and has also struggled with the concept before, is a legislative scheme exclusively for medical malpractice actions. And this court has recognized that if you take a plaintiff on the one hand who has been injured in an automobile accident and a plaintiff on the other hand who has been injured as a result of medical negligence, there can be inequitable results. But the legislative scheme and the legislature in this state has formulated the scheme for policy considerations which still exist today. Psychiatrists are entitled to the same protection as other health care providers. They still must be prevented from stale claims. They still are entitled to gather evidence in a fresh manner to try to keep the cases down. This case, as I think you have probably already taken notice of, involves Legion Insurance Company, who is in bankruptcy and is trying to rehabilitate itself in this case as an insurer of psychiatrists and psychologists throughout the United States. One has only to open up the newspaper to see that there is a medical malpractice crisis. And so what can be done about it? But to try to interpret the legislative scheme in a strict manner.
Ms. Newcomb, what's your position as the appropriate statute of limitations here?
89355.
Well, that I know. I want to know what it means.
Okay.
89355-1A is a 3-year statute of limitations, right?
That's true.
And for Dr. Olson, that, what's your position? It runs from 9/24/93?
It runs from August 3, 1992.
Okay.
And August 3, 1992 was the date of Dr. Olson's last treatment of Sherry Storm. He moved out of state at that time.
Okay.
Three years from August 3, 1992, which would take it to August 3, 1995.
And so that it's outside. No add-ons.
There are no add-ons.
Okay. Does the 5-year statute of repose in 89355-1B attach on to 89355-1A as a matter of law?
As a matter of law, no. As a matter of argument, it doesn't get what the plaintiff, where the plaintiff needs to be, because of really two things. If Ms. Storm did not discover her injury, in other words, she was involved in the treatment and did not discover the injury until some other point, the most logical point that we have is February of 1997, when Ms. Storm, not only, she didn't go into just any trial. It was a trial that Attorney Smoller was representing the plaintiffs in, where the claims were against Dr. Olson and Legion Insurance Company in the same type of case. Even before that, Ms. Storm knew enough to file on her own behalf for Social Security benefits. But that doesn't necessarily mean if you're looking for a definitive time that she might have discovered she has a potential claim. And that's, I think, the language, Justice Abramson, that you used if there was to be a jury instruction on this. Now, I don't think the legislature intended that in every medical malpractice case that we as attorneys have to use up the taxpayer money to go and have a trial to try to determine when the statute of limitations runs. That's why it's important to look at 893.55. And it's my view that 893.55 statute of repose applies to both the injury Part A limitation as well as the discovery limitation. And again, looking at this with fresh eyes, when I first started doing medical malpractice.
Ms. Newcomb, let me interrupt you. Isn't there some language in Paul v. Skemp which would seem to run counter to that?
There's some language, Justice Crooks, that I am intimately aware of. And it says and it says that it may, I believe, is the way it's put. I'm reading between the lines, but I don't think that the issue in the Paul case was directly that issue. So there is some language about that. But when I took a look at 893.55 for the first time, and when I took a look at it this weekend, the note just immediately below the statute itself is a legislative committee note.
Judicial counsel.
Judicial counsel note, thank you. And the judicial counsel note indicates that subsection 1 further provides that in no event may a malpractice action be commenced later than 6 or 5 years from the time of the alleged act or omission. That's what it states.
The only place that act or omission is used is in 1B, right? Those terms aren't used in 1A.
That is true.
And isn't that part of the argument?
Well, that's part of the opponent's argument, right. Yes.
And how do you answer that?
I answer it by common sense, and again, looking at the entire legislative scheme, that the statute was put together to try to have some finality for doctors or healthcare providers so that they could know when it was that it was too late to bring a claim. And so it's not artfully drawn, but nor is 893.56 artfully drawn, nor is 893.16 artfully drawn. But we're left with this mess to try to make some sense out of it. And I believe that if you take a look, the alleged act could refer to the alleged act of negligence or the omission. Okay, as opposed to the injury. We would not be back in court and having 3 or 4 cases a year come in front of the courts of appeals and the Supreme Court if there was some finality to this.
Go ahead, Justice Prosser.
I'm sorry to be sort of dense on this, but I think you are saying, at least in part, 893.16 does not apply because of subsection 3, and your position, I think, is that plaintiff was not mentally ill on August 3rd, 1992. Is that your position?
If 893.16 applies at all, you know, if this court were to find that in medical malpractice actions that a plaintiff could use 893.16 to extend the statute of limitations, my argument is even then it does not apply in this case because it says a disability does not exist for the purpose of this section unless it existed when the cause of action accrues.
When is your position of when the disability began, if at all?
The record is not clear on that because the plaintiff has not met the burden of putting that into the record in opposition to the motion for summary judgment. I don't know because in the complaint it just doesn't even mention it. We are left to guess. And because the plaintiff hasn't met the burden, I believe that the defendants are entitled to have the trial court's decision affirmed. I should also...
Let me just interrupt.
Yes.
If I understand your position is 893.551A, 3-year statute of limitation, applies here.
That's true.
893.16 doesn't apply at all.
Right.
Because 893.55 occupies the field for Med Mal. That was your whole discussion about 655, if
yes.
I understood it. If the court should find that 893.16 does apply to Med Mal cases, then your position is it doesn't apply here because she had no mental disability at the time the cause of action accrued. The cause of action accrued at the last date of treatment.
That's true.
That's your summary of your position.
That's true.
And as also a backup position, if I understand it, is that the 5-year statute of repose applies to 1A. So the last time you could have brought a cause of action on this case, regardless of disability,
right,
was 5 years from the act or omission, which would be the last date of treatment.
And that would be August 3, 1997. Yes. Mm-hmm. Now, Mr. Smoller...
Ms. Newcomb?
Yes.
Are you still answering just the Chief's questions? Or?
No, I was going to follow a train of thought, but go ahead.
Okay, let me tell you what the problem I have with your case. We've got two seemingly contradictory statutes. You say that 55(1) occupies the field. Your opponent says 16 is an exception to (1). So our job is to discern the intent of the legislature. The legislature does this to us once in a while and gives us conflicting statutes. So I look at 893.16 and I see that the legislature there knew how to accept certain lawsuits when it wanted to. Subsection 5 says this section applies only to statutes in the chapter limiting time, and it does not apply to actions for recovery of a forfeiture. It doesn't apply to real estate, certain real estate transactions. It doesn't apply to usury. So the legislature knew how to make it not applicable to medical malpractice if it wanted to, because there's evidence here that they did it to others. So now I say, okay, since they knew how to do it, seems to me, therefore, the fact that they didn't do it means that the legislative intent is to provide the extra 5 years.
I would respectfully disagree.
I would expect you to.
and I will... I will say that the legislature knew how to extend the statute in 893.55 by simply saying, please refer to 893.16 if anyone has a disability. They knew how to do that, and they did not do it. Instead, what they did... group of individuals between what I call the birth to 10-year-old range. And they carved out this one exception to that. Now, if the legislature wanted to do more with 893.55. They would have said something more about, by the way, there's another statute for wrongful death that is a general statute for the populace. There's another one now for disability. They didn't do it. So my conclusion is that they intended that this is the be-all and end-all for health care providers. I see that my time is up.
Thank you, Ms. Newcomb.
Thank you.
Mr. Hogan, you have 10 minutes representing Marcelo Castillo.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice Abrahamson, Justices, my name is Mike Hogan. I represent Dr. Castillo in this matter. I have agreed to allow Dr. Olson's attorney to spend 20 minutes, and I've agreed to take 10 minutes because I want to deal with only one issue. Obviously, if you have questions about the other, that's fine. But I deal particularly with the one issue that does not pertain to Dr. Olson, that is that while we do not concede, in fact, strongly disagree that 893.16 applies to 893.55, and while we do not agree that the plaintiffs have proven that Ms. Storm was disabled, mentally disabled as required, you take all that together, and even assuming the truth of those things, Dr. Castillo should be dismissed from this action. And the reason is that because under the 893.16, Ms. Storm's disability ceased when her attorney filed an action in court on September 9th, 1997. The statute says that an action must be commenced within 2 years of the time that the disability ceased. This is the kind of case, I believe, that 893.55 and Chapter 655 intended specifically for someone like Dr. Castillo, who saw a patient briefly and who had peripheral involvement to the care and treatment of this person, and yet is brought in 7 years after the treatment.
He was brought in 1993 and in February, and then was discharged in March of 93. Is that right, Mr. Hogan? Something like that?
Ms. Storm was discharged from the hospital in 1993. The initial complaint naming Dr. Olson and Ms. Cooper, by the way, it's Dr. Cooper, she's a PhD psychologist, that complaint was filed in September of 1997. The amended complaint naming Dr. Castillo was not filed until June 4th of the year 2000. And it is our contention that if you look at the purpose of the disability statute, is to protect those people who are incapable of in some way exercising their rights, however the Chief Justice may define it, that is accomplished through the act of an attorney. And that we know that specifically from the record that Ms. Storm obtained legal counsel in April of 1997, and arguably that in and of itself would be sufficient. But we know for certain in this case that she had an attorney who was willing to exercise her rights and to prosecute her claims for the incidents, for the injury, and for the time periods in which Dr. Castillo had involvement. And that date is when the complaint was filed in September of 1997. The disability tolling statute requires that once that disability ceases, then the action must be commenced within 2 years, which would be September 9th of 1999. The amended complaint was not filed until the year 2000.
Counsel, do we have to define disability in order to determine in this case when the disability ceased? Or can we say, regardless of how you define it, in any way you would define it, the fact that she hired an attorney was then at her, able to assist her, that regardless how you define it, she wasn't disabled as of the time that she retained the services of an attorney or if the action was filed?
My position would be, first of all, you don't have to for my purposes, because as a matter of law, the attorney is there to protect those rights. Now, there also may be some factual issues. The very fact that she was able to say, look, I have a claim, I want to hire you to pursue this, also raises a factual question, but I don't need to get there, because I think as a matter of law, when an attorney is hired, that person's disability ceases. We do know that from 893.16, it is more than just mental illness. Because in 893.16, it says that the action must be commenced within 2 years after the disability ceases. And I would argue that it means that we have to have a disabling mental illness, which would in some way mean that a person was incapable of exercising their rights, to either appreciate it or to do that. In this circumstance, there is a lawyer who, and as we know, all the knowledge and the actions of the attorney are imputed to the client. We have a person then who knows and is capable of exercising that. And so,
Mr. Hogan, if I might interrupt, the Social Security Administration apparently continues to believe, since they're making payments, that Sherry Storm is disabled. How does that enter into this idea that the disability ceased?
I don't believe, and if you look at the record carefully, I don't believe an inability to make a living is what we're looking at here in terms of whether somebody is capable of exercising their rights because of mental illness. And the in fact, this lady was capable of doing that because she asked an attorney. She recognized that there may be a cause of action, and she retained an attorney. So I think those are two different things, and I don't think that rises to the level of proving the kind of mental illness that is necessary to begin to toll the statute of limitations, even if it would exist under 893.55.
Well, I know you've got some case law from other jurisdictions that would support your position, but is there any case law that's clear in Wisconsin on this issue?
Not that I'm aware of.
Well, as I understand your argument, Mr. Hogan, you're saying that 893.16 does not apply because of the language contained within that section that says that the action may be commenced within 2 years after the disability ceases. That's the language that you're relying on, correct?
For that this particular argument,
yeah.
Yes.
But then there's a comma after that, and then there's a big except. Except that where the disability is due to mental illness, period of limitation may not be extended for more than 5 years. It seems to me that you're almost ignoring that part of the statute.
My reading of that is clearly that what they're saying is what they're talking about here is that they're not going to allow the disability to, if a person is mentally ill, they're not going to allow the disability to toll for more than 5 years. The 2 years above that is that if the disability ceases, then they have 2 years to commence the action.
If it never ceases, you're out anyway after five.
If it never ceases, it would be five. I have a problem if it never ceases in this case, because then there would be 8 years, just so you understand.
You have a problem in the sense that it would fall within
the 8 years, with 3 years being the regular statute of limitations.
And the 5 years.
Plus five.
That's correct.
That would get you into 02 or 03 or whatever it is. But
that would get me into 01.
01, okay.
Isn't the term that we have to define here mental illness?
Well, as I've said, I don't believe that that's necessary for the purposes of my argument here. If the court does define mental illness, I would just recommend, and you know, we've suggested several. There's a great deal of language used by many courts in the briefs, but it has to be, I think, necessarily some kind of functional incapacity that does limit or prohibit the person from exercising their rights. And so however you define that, I think it has to be in those terms. And frankly, it would be nice, Mr. Smoller suggested that, if I remember right, that it might want to include that he's unable to assist counsel. That goes beyond, quite frankly, what would be necessary here, it would seem to me, and to be fair. That is a standard for incompetence, not a standard for insanity. Insanity, at least, you know, from the criminals, there are many definitions of insanity, as we've said in the briefs, and I think that was Dr. Olson's brief. There were many definitions of that. The insanity one is that a person is, you know, incapable of appreciating the wrongfulness of their act and conforming their actions, their behavior, if I remember right, way back when I did criminal work. So.
And the incompetency for standing trial is inability to assist counsel. That's not
right.
An insanity, it's an incompetence.
That's incompetence.
But I gather your first line of attack is that 893.16 doesn't apply at all.
Well, my first line of attack is it doesn't matter because the disability ceased. I agree that 893.16 does not apply at all.
But if it does, it ceased and you're home free,
right,
theoretically.
Right.
Except if it never ceased, then you got a problem.
Right. If you buy that 893.16 applies.
Buys it all, right.
And I really believe that it does not apply. If you read, this is a real morass, and Justice Babich referred to 893.16 sub 5. If you look,
the
statute of limitations.
That's the list of accepted sections.
The statute of limitations chapter, 893.55, in 1979, took statutes from all throughout the various chapters of Wisconsin statutes and tried to bring them into Chapter 893. Those exceptions that they're referring to in there, first of all, doesn't include an exception of 893.56, which is interesting to note, but also those that they are referring to are those statutes, by and large, almost without exception, where the statute was from outside of Chapter 893 and they were being brought into 893. Either that or a portion of that statute that they're referring to was being brought into Section 893. I think that it's clear that when the legislature was devising 893.55, its intent was that this was clearly something on its own and independent. And I think the Judicial Council Committee notes bear that strongly. It says that it's been created to precisely set out the time periods within which an action to recover damages for medical malpractice may be commenced. And it sets out in the next paragraph, and I would ask you to review that carefully, because in the next paragraph it talks about, and I think it sets up a statutory scheme, where the legislature is intending that there are varying degrees of allowance here. The first one being 3 years. We're going to maybe allow a little longer for 1 year from the time of discovery. We're going to cut that off when the statute of repose. So it would be my position that this is an, you can't separate A and B in that sense, because the legislative purpose was that this would be an entire statutory scheme for that. And to say that the tolling statute would apply to one paragraph versus another paragraph, I think is incongruous with what the legislature intended. I've already talked too long. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hogan. Mr. Smoller.
Thank you.
Very briefly, I think it was just highlighted the fact that the issue as it relates to Dr. Castillo is really whether or not you decide that a disability ends and therefore there's only a four-year extension under 893.16 because someone hires a lawyer. And perhaps that goes to Chief Justice Abramson's question about the definition of mentally ill, or perhaps that goes to something other than that, which is the legislative intent. And I would submit to you that just, and as I did in the brief, just like infancy doesn't end when a child or someone on behalf of a child files a case on at year five, or imprisonment didn't end when a prisoner files a 1983 case, disability doesn't end simply because somebody has filed a case.
Some would argue that hiring of a lawyer does not evidence the end of a disability, but the beginning of a mental illness.
I suspect there are many. And obviously we stand behind the fact that just like imprisonment doesn't end when you hire a lawyer, infancy doesn't end when you hire a lawyer, that doesn't mean disability ends when you hire a lawyer. If then you get the 5 years, that limit, then we are within the time for Dr. Castillo. I do need to feel compelled to respond to a couple of things raised by Ms. Newcomb. First of all, 893.56 also fits perfectly within what I believe we are arguing on behalf of the plaintiff as legislative intent. 893.56 was intended to lessen the duration during which minors could bring a malpractice case. If 893.16 didn't apply to malpractice cases, 893.55 came first. 893.56 is wanting to decrease when minors could bring it. If 893.16 didn't apply, there was no reason to bring 893.56. In fact, it would have been extending the time during which minors could bring their claim, and that's inconsistent with everything we understand that legislation wanting to apply. Secondly, the language of 893.56, any person under the age of 18 who is not under disability by reason of insanity. I don't know how many people fall within that category of that exception, but there was no reason for that exception unless 893.16 obviously was going to apply. I also feel compelled to respond to a couple of statements that were made. It was suggested that there was no allegation of disability, or that on summary judgment we hadn't proven the disability. I would cite you to page 32 of my brief, which cites you to the record that includes Dr. Olson's letter saying disability, Dr. Spiro's extensive examination indicating that there was disability. That would give you the record cites, but I'm satisfied that the response to the summary judgment motion was adequate in terms of setting forth that Sherry Storm was disabled.